every time a professor or a left-leaning academic speaks, they think they're speaking to the entire world. There is no frame. I have colleagues in faculty meetings who are like, I am speaking truth to power. I'm like, where is the power? Where is the power? We're trying to determine like how many credits a student needs. So there's this heroics, and you're always thinking you're transgressing with regard to a power, and you're absolutely not able to actually speak to communities, to constituencies, much less to the working class.
For all the horror that we see in, you know, the way things are playing out right now in politics in the world and in the US in particular, it could be said that people might try to give a justification for some of the transgression by saying, well, look, the project of neoliberalism and globalization, it benefited the successful, but it left the rest behind. There wasn't that thinking of what we owe each other. And for that reason, you know, we haven't got time to just gradually adjust. We've got to tear things down. We've got to break them down. We've got to start again. And I'm sure well-intentioned people in the MAGA camp are trying to think of it that way. Is there any justice in thinking of things like that?
Are we projecting ourselves into MAGA world? I think it's good to think dialectically. There is no MAGA without, I think, a liberal hubris that we've all been talking about a little bit in different ways. But I think that, and I talked about this in my academy talk, and it just came out that a study of American families and individuals has shown that 60% of Americans have trouble securing the minimum requirement for dignified lives.
Yeah.
Which means transportation, housing, education, leisure time.
Yeah.
And this institute has, you know, given a more holistic picture of what it is to be human in a society that rather than just having GDP, median GDP metrics. And so if you imagine there are the majority of Americans who feel completely abandoned by the global, by austerity, by globalization, and by the liberal institutions like higher education that keeps coming up with more far-fetched ways of dealing with each other that sort of the common sense mind rebels against. So I feel like there is a wholesale abandonment of the working class. You cannot have a stable society with this much economic polarization. Of course, you're going to have this political polarization, but I want to get back to this idea of like the intellectual, the spiritual, the theoretical leaders who are, you know, so hubristic right now. And one of the things that I think we've lost sense of in my profession, and partially it's because of the success of the counterculture, it's partially because of the success of the capture of the institutions by that post-68 generation. I know I keep going back to this, but I'm sorry, I have to. Is that every time a professor or a left-leaning academic speaks, they think they're speaking to the entire world. There is no frame. I have colleagues in faculty meetings who are like, I am speaking truth to power. I'm like, where is the power? Where is the power? We're trying to determine like how many credits a student needs. But graduate. So there's this heroics, and you're always thinking you're transgressing with regard to a power, and you're absolutely not able to actually speak to communities, to constituencies, much less to the working class. And part of this is this kind of post-68 hubris where we've reached an idea that we are always dissenting, when in fact the professional managerial class has been enshrined as the spokespeople of capital to the rest of the world. And the environmental issue is very much salient here. Why is there no mass movement for environmental policies? Because environmentalists usually come from wealthy elites, and they tell everyone that they're really bad people because they don't recycle. We look at the consumer end of practices rather than the production end of practices. And part of this is that you feel that we have this enshrinement within the individual, within the lifestyle, within self-optimization of improvement. I always like to say, like, when you feel like there is despair about actually improving the lot of the world. All you have is home improvement and self-improvement.
So I like that. So I'm thinking about this for years, very much in the consumer. It shows very much in the consumer society. But does that mean that we should sign up for a little bit of transgressiveness in our politics now?
What do you mean?
Well, the breaking of codes and norms and standards, where we've been subscribing to the rule of law, where we've been saying that, you know, we will abide by international rules and international bodies. How transgressive are we prepared to be or allow to meet some of the conditions that you've just been talking about, where a lot of people are left out of success and prosperity?
I think that one thing that would begin with the project should begin with the lack of democratic transparency in these institutions,
yeah,
global and, you know, national as well. And this happens on a macro level. It happens on a micro level. But what I'm really concerned with is the role of the academic and the intellectual here. I think we've abdicated our ability to reason for a kind of false identification with egos, with the id, actually. And so we identify with enjoyment, but also with punishment. And, you know, we're always telling people that they are not accepting our rules, but then we also say, oh, we love all the popular culture things that everyone else loves. What we have is an ability, a unique ability to see a totality, to not speak to just power, but to actually understand what is broken in our communities. As a Asian American woman within the academy, I see other minority people often construed and reified as representatives of their community. I am not an elected leader of the Chinese American community, nor should I ever pretend to speak to that community. Mm-hmm. But the liberal elites want me to do that.
Yeah.
And I think that we should understand what comes out of leadership that's democratic, what comes out of leadership that is moral, what comes out of leadership that is intellectual. We have no understanding of this anymore. And I blame this hubristic generation of boomerites who came out of 68. I blame Edward Said. I blame the Birmingham School. I blame hippies, sorry. And who just say, like, we're at the vanguard. The vanguard of what?
You've just lost a lot of hay on what?
I know, I'm sorry. I like to be contrarian.
Go on.
I'm transgressing.
You're transgressing.
Well, you know, speaking as somebody born in 1950, I feel in the spotlight here. But I think what needs to be asked here in response to your question, Barry, is when we use transgressive, as you did just then, what we really mean is some kind of disruptive activity in the service of another kind of decision-making. Look at the most successful forms of what you might call constructive disruption in the last half century or a bit more. Look at the civil rights movement. Look at various kinds of nonviolent protests that have actually taken us forward. Transgressive, the word doesn't sit very comfortably. Disruptive, sometimes. Denying the rule of law, no. Because exposing yourself to the way the rule of law may clamp down on you. But by so doing, highlighting the fact that the law as it's exercised is not doing its job. Mm. Now, that, yes, absolutely. A critical, potentially at times disobedient culture, that's a healthy culture, all right? A skeptical culture, to some degree, yes, fine. Are we creating the tools for that kind of argument? I think that, if I hear you right, Catherine, that's one of the questions they're asking. Are we in any sense helping people to have arguments in a culture where actually argument as such is so often just abandoned in favor of position taking, which is another form of heroics, a performative radicalism, which doesn't actually look at changing, I think.
Yes, the performativeness of replacing truth with like on social media, I think, is one of the worries, where that feels like you're an activist because you've liked something.
Well,
So I'm wondering whether there's been a complacency nonetheless, and maybe what we're seeing in Trump and other regimes who seem actually transgressive in the worrying sense, Rowan, in which they really are being transgressive and not just disruptive. it's beware the backlash. That was a backlash against something where there was culpability. I mean, academics did not question the state of democracy. They had benefited from it and they relied on it. And we brought it out and we tried to bomb other countries into adopting democracy. But at the same time, our democracy in the West was really rather complacent. It was decadent. You know, parties got elected who saw their only job as getting themselves re-elected and stopped governing. So I'm wondering whether that need to actually examine our own conscience was something that was missing all along.
I think part of it is to cultivate the willingness always to ask yourself, why do I think this is obvious, before I act on that assumption.
Yeah,
that's the critical and skeptical.
So if I could say something about this, I think that right now there are sort of extra legal forms of censorship around the question of Palestine and Israel. And I think that we should test all those limits. However, I worry that this movement, especially as it exists on campuses, and I don't know if it's the same situation in the UK, it'll produce another kind of micro-political movement that fails to win mass appeal and that serves the heroic gestures of my class rather than the good of the majority of Americans. So we should all be deeply concerned and speak out about the 2 million Palestinians who are being persecuted and some of them starved to death. On the other hand, I look at this movement and I think, you know, if I were a working class person, I would say, like, what about the 180 million Americans who can't really feed themselves or pay for their car insurance or go to work or pay for their health care? So I worry about the nature and the evolution of, once again, these hothouse movements that take up this moral cloak, which should be taken up, which test and transgress the limits of what we can say about Palestine and Israel, but fail to follow up with any kind of appealing politics that can win mass movements.
Yeah, I mean, that seems right. And I want to come back to some of the motivations for the political transgression. I mean, you could see communities who just feel, especially in the U.S., you know, the deal was that I would work in a factory doing a pretty unpleasant job, maybe doing the same thing routinized day after day, but I would be able to eventually own my own home and my kids would go to college and they would do better than me. And when it became obvious after 2008 that that wasn't going to happen and the deal was off, there wasn't necessarily a sense of, you know, where do we go with policies, but the whole thing needs to be smashed up a little bit. I wonder whether anger as one of the motivations for transgression is quite important here, because it's not so much the virtue-seeking idea of being a hero and I'm representing myself as standing up to tyranny, as I'm angry as hell and I'm not going to take it any longer.
Yes, indeed. But in what mode are we going to allow ourselves to express that anger? There's an Italian psychoanalyst, a very interesting thinker, Massimo Recalzati, who came up with a notion of really the predicament of the younger generation today. He calls it the Telemachus complex. Telemachus, of course, being the son of Odysseus, who is trying to protect the maternal space, the maternal home, from the suitors. And he's calling for Odysseus to come back home and restore the law. Now, it's a kind of transgression in the sense that it's saying to the older generation, not we stand against you and we reject your laws, but on the contrary, you've abandoned a kind of lawful, stabilizing space, and we need you back to restore it for us. Now, I think that gives us a kind of internalized notion of authority that is not opposed to the goodness and the creativity and the naturalness of the human being. I think we are saddled. I mean, this is another specter that might be haunting this discussion, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I think we're saddled with a kind of Rousseauistic notion of authority and law as being a kind of foreign imposition from the outside onto the goodness and naturalness of human creativity and morality. We don't have a sense that morality is constitutive of not just social life, but actually of the management of the interior. You know, people like to talk about how the Freudian unconscious speaks for the venality and greed and voraciousness of the sexual drives or the destructive drives. What it doesn't talk about is that the Freudian unconscious says no as much as it says yes. Repression is also unconscious. The law and prohibition is also part of unconscious life, which I think puts into question this valorization of a naturalness that stands against all forms of authority. So to take it back to the Israel-Palestine question, I think how it feels at the moment in the atmosphere on campus is a kind of, it feels as though there is a kind of rage which expresses itself as a wish to tear down all the authorities that are operating in the region, as opposed to a mass movement to say, we need to restore law. We need to restore norms of interaction and of the relationship between communities. That in a way is a reclamation of something like common decency.
It is, but it's a very Irenic vision, and one I think all of us would want to sign up to, and probably everyone in the room. But I'm kind of wondering whether, if Odysseus isn't coming back, the responsibility really has been ceded, and you know the people before us really did trash the climate. They united the successful against the rest. They've let democracy become very decadent, and isn't rage a legitimate response? I mean, it seems very Irenic to think, let us restore what you haven't done. Let us take your responsibility for you.
Well, if rage takes the form of stimulus response.
To continue watching this video, click the link in the top left or in the description below.
With a free trial, you can enjoy the full talk and thousands more.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.